Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what's going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and stats guru.
Last week was upset week, all over the Power Four conferences, and we also had a fan favorite match between Nebraska and Wisconsin in Madison. Let's get started.
The week started off with Washington beating number 10 Oregon in five.
This was just the beginning of the chaos that was going to ensue in NCAA volleyball this week.
We had several players from Washington play really well. We had Keuni Fletcher hit 455. We had Kirsten Barton hit 333. And Julia Hunt hit 500.
Those are some decent numbers.
I thought the most interesting part of that match was that Washington took the lead early in both the fourth and the fifth sets and never gave up the lead. It was a really strong performance for them at the end of the match. We also had number 13 Arizona State beat number 22 Utah handily 3-0, and number 16 Georgia Tech beat number 25 UNC in a close five-set match.
And now we get to the real shockers. On Friday, number 5 Stanford lost in 5 to Miami. We will talk about this briefly, but they did recover on Sunday with a 4-set win over number 23 Florida State. Both of these matches were on the road. The Stanford-Miami match was very weird.
The only thing I can say is that the top teams need to not go to 5 sets. They have to work to be efficient in 3 or 4, because you never know what's going to happen in that fifth set. You had Grace Lopez for Miami hit 407 on 54 balls in that match. And I mean, you were watching the blocking. What did you think?
She was having one of those matches that nothing could go wrong. Honestly, the 5-setters this season are the NCAA giant killers. Because, like, Grace Lopez was playing pretty well the whole match, and then in the fifth set, I'm watching this happening. Stanford has got a solid block in her face every time. They're getting great touches on these swings that just happen to go out, that just happen to catch their hand wrong. For all intents and purposes, Grace Lopez should have been shut down hard on 7 balls in the fifth set.
But and she scored on all of them.
But she scored on all of them. They just missed the sideline. Or, like, Stanford's block was good. It was solid. It was set up right. But it was just one of those games that you almost felt bad for Stanford because they had no business losing it, honestly.
Well, Miami was out of system for 70% of the fifth set.
I don't think I saw their setter set a ball inside of 13 feet the whole match.
And I mean, you have to give Miami credit where credit is due. They pushed the match to 5. They did play well. They battled hard. They gave themselves a chance, but that was Stanford's game to lose, I thought.
Okay. I don't, like, granted, Miami was setting every single ball from, like, the baseline, but their hitters know how to hit out of system. I will give them that.
Fair.
I will say, you know, they have a lot of international players who play for their national teams. You do see in the international game, players tend to be a little more confident and adept at hitting those out of system balls and finding ways to score when they're in trouble. Those players for Miami, they did that. And I don't know if they're just in practice. To be honest, I haven't seen them play. I don't know if they're in practice for hitting out of system, if that's, like, the norm for them, but they were fearless. They were taking big swings on uncomfortable plays. So that was a positive. I could not help but feel bad for Stanford, though, because, like, Sammy Francis, their middle, she was virtually unstoppable on both sides of the ball.
Correct.
Offensively and from the blocking side, She was outstanding. I did think Ilya Rubin was a little streaky. Like, she had moments where she was just, like, flying high and was looking so good. And then she would, like, make a couple weird errors in a row. Also, it looked like they were playing in a high school gym. Stanford was ricocheting balls off of that ceiling like crazy.
And that's... It's definitely a factor if you're not used to playing with a ceiling that low. However, it's probably something that by the end of the match you should have adjusted to.
Agreed.
It's not an excuse for them losing, in my opinion.
No. I mean, there is something to be said for playing in that environment often and being used to that. Like, early in the match, I think it did get better. Early in the match, it was happening a lot. But yeah, all that being said, like, when I saw the result, I was shocked that Stanford lost to Miami, so I went and watched it, and it was unfortunate because Stanford was doing the right things to be able to win, and they got some really unfortunate bounces off of the block, I thought.
To me, the takeaway after that match is, hey, we needed to take care of that match in four so that you have control of whether a player gets hot. Like, nobody gets hot for 25 points, you know. So that would be my takeaway for Stanford.
And that's the thing. They had no business losing that fourth set.
Correct.
They were up 24-22 in the fourth. And then they let the foot off the gas for just a second. And then all of a sudden they're going back and forth to, like, what was it, 30-28 or something?
31-29, yeah.
Yeah. So they should have finished it in four. Again, you have to give Miami credit for making do and for, like, finding a way to gut it out. But, yeah, that one was unfortunate. Number 9, Texas, is going through it, ladies and gentlemen. They lost both of their matches this week. Both of them at home. Both of them in five. They lost to 2 unranked opponents in Missouri and Oklahoma. They are now 0-5 in 5-set matches this season. Yet another example. The ranked teams need to stop going 5 for their own safety. After the Missouri loss, that was the first time that Texas had lost 3 home matches in a season since 2006. We're talking since your girl Sarah P, that's me, played. That's a long time ago. I couldn't even find any data on the last time they lost 4 matches at home in a season. This is wild.
You beat them at home in 2006, didn't you?
Yes.
I just thought I'd throw that in there.
I mean, I wasn't going to say anything, but since you brought it up, yes.
And we don't need to get into the specifics of that match because we looked at Texas in depth last week. But to me, it was a microcosm of the same issues. They are relying on 2 players. They're setting 80% of their balls to those 2 players. And don't get me wrong, Madison is incredible. She's playing really well. She's the only reason they're in those matches. But it's really hard to carry your team match in and match out, especially when you go to 5, because that just allows teams to get a read on the setter, the situation, to find the timing on the block. It makes your life really difficult.
Literally nothing changed from last week to this week. I will say against Oklahoma, it looked like they switched to a 5-1 with Avery Carlson. Ella Swindle, who was a starter on the national championship team last year, did not play. I don't know if she was injured, if that was, you know, a tactical decision to be like, the 6-2 is not cutting it, so we need to change something. Devin Kahahawai also didn't play. I mean, she entered every single set, but, I mean, Rutherford is their go-to opposite. Madison Skinner's numbers against Oklahoma, she hit 122. So, I mean, she had a lot of points, but the efficiency, she was making a lot of errors. And actually, against Oklahoma, Texas was outblocked 17-10. So I think that kind of tells a story about the errors offensively on Texas's side. But, like, in the Missouri game, which we did watch, it really looked like Missouri's outsides, the game plan was to just swing high seam every ball. They did not try to do anything else, And Texas's defense didn't adjust.
All they needed to do was slide their six back into the seam of the block. They would have had double-digit more digs over top of that block. Their coaching staff just didn't make an adjustment. The six stayed in the same place. I didn't see anything change in those matches, and I was shocked.
It was really disappointing, to be honest. And just hearing Jared Elliott's feedback after the Texas A&M loss last week, his statement was, "Oh, we made too many hitting errors." And it's like, yeah, no kidding, Jarrett. But, like, you're saying what the end result is. Like, why aren't we examining the cause of that? And, like, after we watched the Texas A&M match, it was like your setting was not putting your hitters in a position to be successful. Sure, they were making a lot of errors. But, like, you're fixating on the end result instead of, like, the process into what got you there. And it just seems like that was a lot of number crunching instead of really looking over the game film and making the change that needed to be made. Because we saw it against Missouri. Nothing changed.
So my question to you is, the setter selection for the second match, do you think that was message sending, or do you think they chose the setter they thought would give them the best chance to win that match?
Texas is in a position that they can't mess around right now. So I think if it wasn't an injury decision, I think it was a decision to try to be as successful as possible. Because honestly, when we have been watching Texas, Ella Swindle is not connecting with the hitters at all, with nobody. It's been very strange to see. So I think Carlson was their choice to try to get them a win, because at this point they can't afford to make any more mistakes.
And in fairness to the setters, they're only setting two rotations each. They're leaving the right side in to set, they're going through two rotations coming out. That's a tough ask for a setter. You have no chance to find a rhythm.
Well, Reagan Rutherford is serving and then she's setting,
and I'm sorry, her serve is not good enough. She's not scoring that many points on her serve to not have a setter in there to run your offense. That doesn't make any sense to me.
My theory is that Ella Swindle has the yips. That's my theory. Because there is no reason why you shouldn't be bringing your setter in to serve when Rutherford has, like, a pretty standard, by-the-book jump float serve. It's not like she's going up and hammering spin serves and getting aces. So my theory is Swindle has the yips. She's having trouble with her serve. They're not sure what to do, and here we are.
So let's move into our feature matches for the week. We're going to look at number 13, Arizona State, beating number 20, BYU, in 5. And then, because everybody wants it, Nebraska crushed Wisconsin 3-0. So we'll talk about that, even though I'm not sure how much there is to say.
Yeah, I don't think anybody expected that 3-0 beatdown, but everybody loves that matchup, so we're going to dive in. We're going to start off with Arizona State against BYU. We haven't seen Arizona State play yet this year, and since they're, like, among the top of the Big 12, we wanted to check things out. BYU is a pretty hostile environment normally, so we figured this would be a good test to see Arizona State play.
Now, I heard there weren't as many people there as there normally are.
Too busy trick-or-treating.
Well, that's fair. But I really liked Arizona State. As a team, I thought they did a really good job. Argentina Ung, the setter, I thought she played really well. I liked the offense that she ran. I thought Savannah Colheed played incredibly well as a middle. She hit .667. She was incredibly effective. I thought she blocked pretty well. I was impressed with Jelly Sear. She didn't hit super efficiently in that match. She was only 188. However, she passes really well. She hits out of the back row. She plays defense really well. And so, as an all-around six rotation player, I thought she brought a lot of stability to that team.
Yeah, my ASU standouts were actually the libero, Mary Schroll, the outside, Jelly Sear, and Savannah Colheed as well. I agree with you. I think Jelly Sear is, like, the perfect outside hitter number two, the perfect ball control outside. The thing about ASU, though, is I don't think they have a true point scoring left side.
And I think that's where Argentina Ung really impressed me, was when you don't have a stud that you can set all the time, how you run your offense and the position you put your hitters in is becomes more important. And I thought she did a good job of that.
I think when everything is in system, ASU runs an incredibly fast offense.
I agree.
Probably the fastest that we've seen so far.
Yeah.
And when things are smooth and in system, Argentina Ung sets very well.
Yep.
I think as soon as the passes or the digs start to come off the net a little bit, she tries so hard to maintain that tempo, but she doesn't give the ball any shape, which you need when you're moving off the net. And you saw the balls kind of like die really early, and the hitters were having trouble kind of like hitting those balls. I think when everything is smooth and all is good, yeah, she is setting outstanding, but she's making life really difficult with that tempo she wants to run when things aren't perfect.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but that only happens to the left side. I feel she runs the middle slide pipe pretty well regardless of the situation, and I agree that the left side set is really fast when she's off the net.
I'm also kind of confused about what they're doing with Argentina Ung, their setter. They bring in their backup setter to be a serving specialist and a DS. And in those situations, I'm pretty sure it's an audible in the moment if Argentina Ung feels like setting or hitting. And you could see some miscommunication at times as to who is actually setting. And quite frankly, Ung was not an efficient hitter. It's like a fun twist, I guess, keep people on their toes, but like it's causing more problems than it's worth.
That I agree with. She was negative 111 on the attacks that she made, and not having a system or understanding what you're trying to do, I think just causes more confusion than it's worth. The other part is Roberto Rabella, who comes in the front row occasionally, I thought played really well and swung, you know, 438 on the 16 balls that she hit. She was a good factor for that team when she came in.
The Brazilian right side?
Correct.
Yes. I think she was pretty effective for them. Going back to what you were saying about the setter, I think when ASU can run the middle, they are very good. When the middle is an option, both Claire Jeter and Savannah Colheed are outstanding. I think they were very difficult to stop. But as soon as the middle becomes a non-option, which is dictated by the pass or the dig, that's when the wheels kind of fell off, and the connection there between the speed, set location, etc., it kind of fell apart.
And I don't disagree with you on that. I wouldn't say she's the best out-of-system setter, but they were in system enough, and I really liked her total distribution in terms of how she used her hitters. And, I mean, no setter is going to be perfect at everything. That's her weakness. But I thought, for the most part, her distribution and the decisions she made were quite good.
I think overall, though, the story of the game came down to serve and pass. When we're looking at the serving numbers, Arizona State had 8 aces and 11 errors. BYU had only 2 aces and 13 errors. And I will say, like, as the sets were progressing, it was very clear early which team was going to win the set.
Yeah.
Because the passing would break down immediately. And, like, the teams didn't really do a good job of recovering their side out or their serve receive ability, like, as the set progressed. It was just, like, blocks of time where the passing just disappeared.
Well, and you saw it because once the fourth and the fifth set hit, Arizona never gave up the lead. They were in control the whole time, winning 25-14 and 15-7 in the fifth. And BYU just couldn't match them. In the fourth set, they hit 067, and in the fifth set, they hit 211. And Arizona was 300 and 300 plus in both of those sets. They just couldn't keep up.
I think another thing is that BYU is very, very dependent on one hitter in Claire Little. I think early in the match, she was almost unstoppable. She was hitting everything, and I have a lot of respect for that because she wasn't being given great sets all the time, but she knows her role. She knows her job is to score points, and she was just going for it. She hits a heavy ball that Arizona State was having a really hard time controlling, particularly early. But I think Arizona State made a great defensive adjustment on her as the match progressed, in that when Claire Little was getting set out of system, the libero was dropping almost into the corner in position five, and they had the off blocker, the left side, come all the way completely behind the 10-foot line. They were giving her a sharp angle because out of system, Little was really hammering hard angle, and they just couldn't cover it with just the libero. But then when she was in system, they had the libero come up and straddle the 10-foot line, and the off blocker left side was coming in directly for tips. And I think that that adjustment, because they were playing her straight up traditional, the same look no matter what the situation was early, but that adjustment, being able to identify when Little was in system versus out of system, they got so many more chances on her, and that was the difference, I thought.
And that's where I thought that Jelly and the libero did a really good job being on the same page, covering the court, and getting chances. The other thing that Arizona State did was they served her a ton. She struggled to pass. They weren't aces, but high around the attack line, working for that out-of-system ball so that they could be in those positions, and they came at her relentlessly.
I will say middle blocker Brielle Kemavor also played really well. I thought that she was a great offensive weapon for BYU too. I just think at this point in time, BYU is a little one-dimensional and a little too reliant on Claire Little. Like, that is a lot of weight to put on one player. Offensively, she does a great job. I think she's handling it well. She's scoring very well, but she's getting over two times the amount of sets. I think during the broadcast, we heard that she has had almost 400 more sets than the second highest attacker on her team.
Well, in this match, she had 52 attempts, and the next closest person had 28, who was Ellie Mortensen, who I thought struggled in that match. For them to beat good teams, she needs to be a weapon, and she...
Well, her hit, or the right side.
Yeah, she hit 107. It just wasn't good enough. Everybody knew when they needed a point who was getting set, and that's a hard load to carry.
I do want to give a shout-out, though, to Hannah Billiter on BYU. She is one of the serving subs slash DS. When she's serving, that is a great rotation for BYU. She doesn't always get aces, but she's putting teams in trouble, and I would say that that is their most efficient sort of defensive transition rotation, and they're scoring the most points when Billiter is serving. And I've noticed that across, like, multiple matches now.
The other thing to remember is that I think BYU is very young, so Claire Little's doing a good job of handling the pressure. But I think as a team, they will grow. BYU plays a lot of five-set matches. They will get better as the season goes on, and they'll be even better next year.
I mean, this was another example of a team that kind of recruited young high school kids versus a team that recruited from the portal. And Arizona State has a lot of graduate students, a lot of upperclassmen, a lot of them from other schools. It was interesting. I think BYU definitely does have a bright future. It was good to see Arizona State play. I'm very, very curious to see how they handle Kansas next week.
That's going
to
be a fun match to watch.
And it is fun to see how fast of an offense they run, because it's faster than anything we've seen, as we've said. But, like, if they can just dial in that connection when the pass isn't there, I think they'll be a lot better.
So now the match that everybody was looking forward to this week, and while it wasn't a five-set barn burner, I still think it was a pretty good match overall. What were your initial thoughts?
I would agree that the sets were good until about 20. It was very back and forth, super tight, until we hit 20 points, and then without fail, around that mark, Nebraska would score two or three in a row, and that was that.
What did you see those runs after 20? Where did they come from?
In at least two of the three sets, they happened in the exact same rotation with Olivia Mauch serving. They got stuck with Lola Schumacher, the freshman libero for Wisconsin, in position one. And Mauch was serving her line to line, and there were bad passes, miscommunication, any number of things, but it was that same rotation every time.
One of the things that I noticed in the match was I thought that freshman setter Furbringer was struggling to connect with her middle hitters. They only had 13 sets in the middle, and I understand that they ran Schmreck a few balls out of the middle, but even still, she wasn't effective, and I thought that really cost them.
It was really tough to run the middle because Wisconsin's passing was so bad.
Fair.
Like, it was almost impossible to run the middle. The only thing they could do was set out of system. And Sarah Franklin is the only player on Wisconsin who can effectively hit out of system. And that became painfully obvious this match.
Well, you had Smrek hit minus 074. And watching her, she needs to add a few more angles to her game. She hits the same. She hits straight often, and while her height and the pace she can put on the ball gets her out of a lot of situations, against Nebraska, who's probably one of the best, if not the best, defensive team in the country, it just wasn't good enough.
No, it's very clear where Anna Smrek is hitting the ball. If she gets out her approach outside a little bit, she's hitting deep angle, and if her approach is inside the court, she's hitting straight down the line. If she's coming into the middle, she hits back to one. Like, she does what she does, and she's been able to get away with it because she's so tall. But like you said, when you've got a competent blocking and defensive team, it's not going to cut it. You need to be more versatile.
One of my favorite players on Nebraska, and we talked about her before, Andy Jackson, has hit 456 this season. And whether it was the size of the Wisconsin block or the game plan, she hit 118 this match. They still set her a whole bunch, which I think they needed to, but she was not effective.
Well, nobody from Nebraska was effective except for Merritt Beeson. Not necessarily effective, efficient. But Nebraska is nothing if not balanced. I feel like they run one of the most balanced offenses in the country. I really think that this match was a blocking match.
I agree.
Both
with that.
Sides knew what the assignment was. I think both teams came in with a very clear plan. It was obvious that Nebraska wanted to stop Franklin for obvious reasons. She carries the load for Wisconsin offensively. And Wisconsin wanted to make it as difficult as possible for Andy Jackson to get the ball. Because when Andy Jackson's an option, there's just too much going on to be able to block and play defense effectively. So we saw Wisconsin serving to zone one a lot, regardless of who was passing there, to try to get Bergen Riley kind of spinning and losing sight of her middle. And we saw Nebraska come at Wisconsin so hard on the serve, particularly at Franklin or in the seam between Franklin and Orzel.
And I thought that the libero for Wisconsin also didn't pass particularly well. And if Wisconsin was going to win this match, she needed to be able to take court and keep them in system, and that did not happen.
I think it's just the passing issues that Wisconsin had just really highlighted how much they rely on Franklin, because they don't have anybody else that can really score out of system. As we mentioned, Smrek does what she does. She's not a great out-of-system hitter. You can't run your middle with the passes that were being delivered that match. And Orzel, she was solid. She was steady for Wisconsin. But it's a tough matchup, her hitting out of system for an entire match.
Yeah, Orzel's the type of player who's going to be steady for you, but she's probably not going to win you the match.
Fair, yeah. I do have to say, I thought CeCe Crawford for Wisconsin blocked very well. There were runs of points there where she ran the show. You can tell that she's very smart, very intuitive. Her deductive reasoning is on point. You could just see her really taking care of business for Wisconsin from a blocking perspective. I thought she did amazing. But it was just like a battle of the game plans. And while nobody hit particularly well for Nebraska other than Beeson, I thought that they backed up their solid blocking with good defense, and their serving pressure didn't relent. Wisconsin, they neutralized their hitters well. They got a ton of blocks. They kept everybody's hitting percentages down, but they really loopholed themselves by not being able to get anybody going offensively.
Well, it's interesting you talk about the defense, because Nebraska had 43 digs on the match and Wisconsin had 42 digs on the match.
Oh.
But I think the difference, and this is where sometimes stats can be deceiving, is Nebraska controlled their defensive touches better than Wisconsin. They generally had two options for hitters instead of one option in transition, and they did a better job of being able to put their hitters in positions to be successful, I thought, than Wisconsin. And so while the numbers are close to equal, I thought they had the advantage in that regard.
And one criticism that I have had of Charlie Furbringer this season is her out-of-system setting. She's obviously young. She's coming into her own. She is a good setter. But I think when she is forced to run around, it's a little inconsistent. And Sarah Franklin, up until this point, has done a really good job of just finding ways to score anyway. I think in this match, Franklin looked out of rhythm. Her approach was a little bit slower. Her arm was a little slow. It was almost like she was trying to see what was going to happen, and she was thinking about her swing instead of just going for it. It wasn't the same Franklin that we saw. And I don't know if that is just like respect for Nebraska or what was going on there, but I have said throughout the season that Furbringer struggles to set out of system consistently.
And again, I think that will come maybe with a little more strength. I thought her all-around game was very good. I thought she served well. I thought she played defense really well. But yeah, I agree with your assessment that she struggled in those situations. And Wisconsin, both their passing and their defense were not always in control.
Again, I don't think the 3-0 score is really indicative of the match as a whole. It was very back and forth. Like I said, both teams had a very distinct and clear game plan, and I think the players executed it well. Beeson stepped up for Nebraska. If she hadn't had those hitting numbers, it might have been a different story. It might have gone like four sets or even further. And honestly, Wisconsin needs somebody else who can be an arm out of system.
And I think that this is where Nebraska has the edge this season, is that all of their outside hitters have the potential to have good matches. It doesn't always happen, but you've seen matches where they've individually gone off, and the percentage chance that, you know, one and a half, two of them will have a good match is just higher than always relying on Franklin, because Orzel, like you said, Orzel's not a great out of system hitter or not consistently going to score you those points. And Schmreck, when the defense is solid and has a good game plan, she's not that player for you either.
It'll be interesting to see how Wisconsin kind of regroups. They are going to have a rematch against Nebraska later this month.
Give me a prediction for that match.
I think Nebraska is still going to win, but I think maybe in four.
That's what I was going to pick. Really? I was going to say Nebraska in four.
Yeah. I do like seeing Beeson coming out of the back row now.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have to give a shout out to Lainey Choboy. I think she does a really good job for Nebraska. Whenever she comes in, she gets at least a dig. She brings energy. She brings fire to the court for them. I'm hoping the next time they play is a little better. From a fan perspective, the volleyball was good. The game plans were solid. I'm just a little more excitement, you know?
A little closer at the end. Give me a couple 2-point sets.
Oh, yeah.
All right, it's time for my favorite part of the show.
Adam makes up a game.
I make up a game, and Sarah has no idea what's going to happen, and we see what she says. So this one is called Pavin's Percentages.
Ooh, I love an alliteration.
I know you do. I am going to make a statement, and you are going to give me a percentage that you think it will happen or come true.
Okay.
Okay. I will also give a percentage, but after you.
Okay.
I like to play too. Okay. First statement. a Final Four team will be playing a true 6-2.
Oh, dang.
Let me clarify. By true 6-2, I mean they're doing it pretty much that rotation every time.
We're not just doing like a blocking sub, double sub situation. It's like every time.
Yeah.
Okay. I have not been loving teams 6-2 situation this year. A Final Four team will be running a 6-2. Louisville is not running a true 6-2, right? They're doing that double sub like once a set.
Yeah, I would say Louisville is not running a 6-2.
Okay. I'm going to say less than 10%.
That's not good enough. I need a number.
I think there is a 7% chance that a team running a 6-2 will be in the Final Four.
I like that. I'm going to go with 16%.
Oh, dang. How can we measure this?
Well, we'll just see what happens.
It's like every team in the Final Four is running a 6-2. You were absolutely incorrect.
Okay. Do you have anything to add, or that's your 7%?
Just all the 6-2s that I've seen being run this season have been very disjointed. The hitters seem to have a really tough time getting in rhythm. The setters seem to have a tough time being in rhythm. It just has not looked good to me. I think there is something to be said about like hitters knowing what to expect. I don't like it.
Okay.
Simple as that. I don't like it.
Sarah Franklin repeats as player of the year. And here is a noteworthy stat that all of her numbers this year are better than last year.
I know for a fact that doesn't matter. I honestly don't think that Wisconsin will make the Final Four this year. It is very challenging. Like, it's challenging to be named Player of the Year if you're not at the Final Four. Given the fact of who I'm thinking will be in the Final Four, do you want me to hear what I'm thinking?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm thinking if Pitt makes the Final Four, Babcock will be Player of the Year. If Penn State makes the Final Four, Mrzek has a good shot at being Player of the Year. I don't think anybody from Nebraska, well, Andy Jackson would be the only pick for me for Nebraska. She's the real, they're too balanced for one player to really stand out. And then Louisville, I don't think so. I think if Wisconsin makes it, she'll have a chance, but I don't think they're going to make it. So I'm going to say there is a 20% chance. That's really low, isn't it?
It's actually playing the field. I think that's a high percentage.
Oh, okay.
I was going to say 8%.
Well,
I also don't think they're going to be in the Final Four. I think it's really hard to repeat as Player of the Year. And they're just not as smooth as they were last year.
There's just like for Player of the Year, there's so many variables that are out of your control.
And you know, percentage-wise, with there being four digits worth of people who are on that watch list,
I mean, seriously,
her chance of winning is
actually
is not
0.01% given all the people that are on the watch list.
Nebraska goes undefeated for the rest of the season until the tournament. Now, matches of note for them are Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Penn State.
Honestly, I think they're going to win all of those matches, so I'm going to make it pretty high. I'm going to say there's a 70% chance that they will go undefeated until the tournament.
Ooh, those are high odds. I was going to go with 51%.
Oh, man.
Just over half.
I guess I'm just confident in them.
Oh, that's fair. So we saw Texas move to a 5-1 in their last match. What are the odds that they play a 5-1 for the rest of the year?
I'm going to say 35%.
Okay. I was going to say 49% only because I don't think they have any idea what to do in Texas right now.
Because they have no idea what to do, I feel like they're going to go with something that the players are at least familiar with for the last little chunk of time. The players have played a 5-1 with Ella Swindle. They've only played one match with a 5-1 with Avery Carlson. I'm not sure if Swindle or Carlson started the season in the 5-1. That I didn't check. But man, I bet they are just reeling right now.
I agree.
They're in panic mode for sure.
Okay, now the last one, we kind of touched on this, and I wasn't sure where this conversation was going to go, but Wisconsin makes the Final Four was the last question.
I think there's probably a 25% chance that they make the Final Four. I am not confident. This is not the Wisconsin team that we've seen in recent years.
I was going to say 33%. I think Franklin is capable of having two good matches to get them to the Final Four if her team can put her in a position to be successful. But
and it depends on their matchup.
Correct.
Because so. Texas is going to fall hard from that NCAA top 16 they came up with. But if we're using that as the reference point, they would be playing Nebraska to get into the Final Four.
Yeah, 33%.
That NCAA top 16 thing is not going to stand now. I think so many wacky things have happened that the NCAA is like, well, that was fun.
You're going to get a new one next week.
Yeah.
Well, that's the game, Pavin's percentages. So I think we've played a few here now. So we'll have to see what we liked. If you guys have an idea or you want us to revisit one of these, please let us know. Sarah will put a poll up.
Oh, okay. Let's do it. It is time for our weekly hot takes. We're going to be a little more specific this week, so get ready. My hot take is that Gulje Gutschkin, the DS for Wisconsin, should be the starting libero for the team over Lola Schumacher. She has only been playing DS this year. Honestly, I think with Gutschkin, you get more leadership qualities. You need that position needs to be confident, needs to be assertive, needs to basically run the back row. And you are not seeing that from Schumacher at all. You're seeing miscommunication. You're seeing her unsure of herself. Honestly, her passing is not good enough, in my opinion, for a team of Wisconsin's caliber. And we see Gutschkin digging in five when she's coming in, moving Schumacher to six or sometimes to zone one. If that doesn't say it, that just proves that Sheffield has confidence in her to be able to make those digs against certain players. Like, I'm confused why Schumacher's the libero. And so that's my hot take for the week. Do you have an opinion?
No, I haven't watched them enough, I would say, to have a sample size. But definitely in the Nebraska game, I was kind of scratching my head and wondering, why is this girl not playing more? I thought she did a great job. The only thing that popped into my head was, I think she's a senior. And
She's a junior.
Okay.
Well, and the thing is, she's coming in as DS, so she's playing half the amount of time as Schumacher. She had more digs in her. And you're playing half the time. That's my hot take of the week.
I'd be curious to know what the rationale behind that was. My hot take of the week is more of a surprise. And
a surprise for yourself or a surprise for the listeners?
Just surprise! Overall surprised at how poor Texas has been. And I know we've talked about them, but my hot take is going to be, I don't think they get it back on the rails. Texas had 8 days in between the A&M match and the Missouri match, and we saw the same thing.
No changes.
And then they randomly go to a 5-1 the next day with no practice.
It's a Band-Aid solution.
I don't think they know what the problem is, and I'm not sure they're going to be able to fix it mid-season. They play too many good teams. It's a short window. And now you don't know whether you're playing a 5-1 or a 6-2. I think they're in trouble.
Well, let us know what you think about these hot takes. We made them a little more specific this week instead of general. Like it, leave it. Either way, we feel strongly about these ones.
Give us your hot take. Looking forward, we got a few matches coming up that we think will be great and you should keep an eye out for this week. On Wednesday, Arizona State is hosting Kansas to see who will sit on top of the Big 12. On Thursday, Nebraska travels to Oregon. We'll watch the scores on that one. I'm thinking Nebraska's going to roll there.
So do I, but like you love a ranked matchup.
Fair.
On Friday, BYU and Utah have their in-state rematch after BYU took down Utah in 5 in Provo a couple weeks ago.
I am feeling Utah for that match, but we'll see where it goes.
I have no idea. I think BYU gains extra superpowers at home, so it'll be curious to see how they play at Utah. But I think the BYU faithful will be traveling there for sure. So
usually travel pretty well.
Yeah.
On Saturday, we've got Penn State and Wisconsin, Oregon and Minnesota, and Stanford taking on Georgia Tech.
It's going to be a great week. Hopefully not as messy as this week. The upsets were out of control.
Well, I feel like at the end of last week, we said the upcoming week will not have that much going on. So the fact that we're expecting big matches, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I thought this week was going to be so straightforward, and it was anything but. So it's just like opposite day here. We'll see what happens. That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.
See you, everybody.